You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn and for Rob Ferret. Wisconsin candidates for U.S. Senator are set to debate tomorrow night, and you can hear it live right here. The Wisconsin Broadcasters Association debate starts at 7. Listen to an hour of debate plus analysis after it wraps right here on the Ideas Network and online at WPR.org. Now, if you've ever wondered about why an apple doesn't fall through your kitchen table, or you fall through the crust of the earth, or the amount of momentum needed to throw a ball, then you've thought about physics. It's everywhere. In fact, you can't escape it. People have tried, whether we think about it or not. And while it can be challenging for me to wrap my head around it, one scientist writes that physics can be approachable and even a dinner table conversation. So, join us for the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. What do you find most interesting about our real world? We talked about quantum physics yesterday and the Nobel Prize for quantum physics. It seems to change everything you thought about physics, at least at the smallest level. So, what do you want to know about our real world and how real it can be? 1-800-642-1234. Our guest, Sean Carroll, professor of natural philosophy at Johns Hopkins University. He's written multiple books on cosmology and physics, and most recently, The Biggest Ideas in the Universe, Space, Time, and Motion, the first in a trilogy. Sean, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much for having me.
So let's start with the biggest thing I can think of, Sean, and that would be infinity. What could be possibly bigger than that? But then as you write in your book, and I'm like, all right, I got you, Sean. And then you write, well, we shouldn't confuse what we can hold in our head with what nature actually does. Are you telling me that nature doesn't do infinity?
I'm telling you that we don't know. I mean, infinity is something where we can talk about it. We often, as mathematicians, as scientists, philosophers, we discuss what properties infinity should have, but we don't actually know for sure whether or not infinity exists in the universe. So I'm very, very, I try to be very cautious about those things that we can say with confidence and those things we're a little bit up in the air about.
Well, something to think about infinity, the number of numbers between 0 and 1 would be the same size of numbers between from negative infinity all the way to infinity. Well, wrap your head around
that. Yeah, that's absolutely true. And this is a crucial fact when we try to understand infinity. This was a brilliant contribution by Georg Cantor, who's a mathematician over 100 years ago, where he realized that there's different sizes of infinity. You're exactly right. The number of numbers between 0 and 1 is the same as the number of numbers between minus infinity and plus infinity, but it's bigger than the number of integers, 0, 1, 2, 3, minus 1, minus 2, minus 3. So there's different levels when it comes to infinity.
Sean, as you begin to approach physics, how do you begin to approach people about physics? It can be a little daunting, I would imagine.
It's absolutely daunting. Look, it's daunting for me, and I've been doing it for many, many years. I'm daunted every day. But that's okay. You know, it's our universe. We all share this universe that we live in, and most of us are very curious about it. I think it's kind of a shame that that curiosity gets pushed down and beaten out of us in some ways by our schooling and the demands of earning a living and things like that. So I want to rekindle that curiosity for the people who have put it aside and feed it for those for whom it's still a big motivation.
And as you wrote about in your introduction, you want to have these conversations with people. You want to have these debates about what really is real out there.
Yeah, I think, again, we do live in the universe. We're curious about it. And that means that we have opinions about it. You know, we think that certain things sound reasonable to us. Certain things sound unreasonable. And when new evidence comes in, new experiments come in, we're always kind of really thrilled to see what we've learned about the universe.
Our guest is the author of The Biggest Ideas in the Universe. And you break down the first book in your upcoming trilogy, Sean, into Space, Time, and Motion. And let's start with space, because my initial thought is space by definition is empty. But as you write, it's filled with information.
Well, space is where we live. You know, physicists think about space maybe in a slightly different way than people do. It's not just outer space. It's really just the set of all possible locations that you can imagine. So you have a location in space. The Earth has a location in space. Some parts of space are empty, but some parts are full of stuff. You know, the center of the Earth is a location in space. We're still, one of the fun things about a book like this is I can admit all of the stuff we still don't understand.
So well, that's refreshing.
Yeah. You know, we're not trying to pretend to know more than we do, even though we know a lot. There's a long running debate that I talk about that goes back to Isaac Newton and Gottfried Leibniz about, is space a thing all by itself? Or is it just a way of talking about the locations and distances between other things? And honestly, we don't know. Still to this day.
If we don't know that, I mean, what else can we not know? What else can we possibly know? But as you're talking about space and how you define it in terms of relationships with other things, I'm thinking about time and how it defines us as relationships in space.
I hope you will not be disappointed if we don't fully understand what time is at the most fundamental level either. But
oh,
I have to emphasize here, you know, there's a difference between understanding something completely and understanding it at all. Like, I don't understand the car I drive completely, right? There's parts of the engine which, if they break, then I'm out of luck. I need to call in an expert. But I can drive it, and I understand a lot about it. And I think that space and time are like that, too. We actually understand a lot about them through the progress that's been made by hundreds of years of physics. So to say that we don't understand everything is not to despair. There's quite a bit that we know.
Like how it operates, like how we operate through it, space and time. But it's Einstein that puts them together, doesn't he? Or it's Einstein and a bunch of scientists around that time that begin to understand these might be inextricably linked.
Yeah, it's a funny story, actually. You know, space and time have been with us a long time, and Isaac Newton gave us a way of thinking about them in which they're both real, but they're completely distinct. You wouldn't mix them up. In 1905, Einstein puts together what we now call the special theory of relativity, and it's 2 years later that his old math professor, Hermann Minkowski, says, you know, Albert, there's a way of thinking about your theory, which is as a unification of space and time into space-time. And Einstein's reaction was, you know, that sounds like, you know, mathematical flummery. It's a little bit, you know, too abstract for me. I'm more down to earth. And it took him a couple of years, but he caught on that actually this space-time conception was the best way of thinking about it.
And this brings us to the final portion of your first book in this trilogy, The Biggest Ideas of the Universe, and that's motion. Because with the space-time continuum now, or these two linked up, we begin to understand motion a little bit better in terms of action at a distance, which it was Newton who said that's an absurdity. I believe no one who has a competent faculty of thinking can ever fall into it. But he was just talking about gravity, wasn't he? Action at a distance, gravity.
He was, and this is important if anyone was listening yesterday when you were talking about the new Nobel Prize and quantum mechanical action at a distance. The idea of action at a distance being troublesome and puzzling goes way back further than quantum mechanics. It goes to Isaac Newton, where he proposed this formula for the force of gravity, that gravity pulls things together, but it fades away as you get further and further away. And so the question arises, what's doing the pulling? What is the thing, the mechanism, the substance that carries the force of gravity? And in Newton's theory, it was nothing. It just happened. And that was the sort of troublesome aspect of the action at a distance. And that actually is something that we have come to understand through the work of people like Pierre-Simon Laplace in France and Einstein himself, that there's a field that pervades the space and time in between the stars and the planets that carries the force of gravity. And then separately, when quantum mechanics comes along, there's a new kind of action at a distance, which Einstein called spooky action at a distance. Yes. And so we're still struggling with that one. I have my ideas. Other people have their ideas. But we're not settled down on that one yet.
Sean Carroll, our guest, professor of natural philosophy at Johns Hopkins University and the author of The Biggest Ideas of the Universe. And as we talk about motion taking place across time, I have to wonder whether or not time can go in the other direction. And you do write about time reversal in your book, Sean. Tell us about it. How does that work?
We talk about time reversal as purely a thought experiment kind of thing. You know, we say, if we take some stuff, some experimental system or whatever, and we let it evolve over time, and then we take exactly the same stuff, but we sort of point it in the other direction, and let it evolve backwards. So if you throw a ball in one direction, it lands somewhere, but then you throw it backwards. So essentially you're doing the same kind of experiment, but in a reversed direction of time. And there's a lot of subtleties there, and I won't go into all of them, but the upshot is that the laws of physics, as we best understand them, are reversible. Whatever you do, you can undo at the fundamental level. It doesn't seem that way in our macroscopic world. You can break an egg, but not unbreak it.
Right.
But the deep down laws of physics that are underlying everything that happens work equally well forward or backward in time.
Which bring us to white holes, not the black holes, the white ones. And we'll continue our conversation and invite you to participate as well as we talk about the biggest ideas in the universe. A deeper understanding of our space, time, and motion with our guest, Sean Carroll, professor of natural philosophy at Johns Hopkins University. And if you have questions about our physical real universe or the quantum level, as we talked about yesterday, 1-800-642-1234 to join us. And we'll continue the conversation next on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we've been going back in time with our guest, Sean Carroll, author of the book, The Biggest Ideas in the Universe, Space, Time, and Motion. He's joining us to talk about our physical reality and how we can make it a little more fun. And you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. And where we left off was talking about going back in time to study white holes and how this leads us to the absolute start of our universe as we perhaps know it, the Big Bang Theory. Sean, what are white holes?
Well, a white hole is exactly a black hole played backward in time, which sounds a little weird because why are you playing black holes forward in time in the first place? But the idea of a black hole does have a directionality of time built into it because it's a region of space-time with the property that once you enter, you can't leave. And of course, we mean going forward in time, you can't leave, right? So it's a one-way kind of trap. So a white hole, is a region of space-time that you can leave, but if you do, you can never go back. Sort of it expels you in some way. And just like a real black hole has the property that if you go in, you will eventually crunch into a singularity of infinite density, in a white hole, everything comes out of a singularity of infinite density. And that's very much like, at least analogous to, what happens in our real universe in the Big Bang.
But Sean Carroll, we started the conversation with my supposition that the biggest ideas in the universe was infinity. You can't get bigger than that. And then you said that just might be in your mind, man. So now we have this infinite density that it is the Big Bang that is the start of our universe as we know it, this singularity.
Yeah, and that bugs us. You know, the very word singularity is supposed to indicate to you that something is going wrong. So this is a feature of Einstein's theory of general relativity that, you know, he wrote down an equation in 1915, and we're still learning about the implications of that equation. So it was Roger Penrose and Stephen Hawking and others who in the 1960s proved that under very wide ranges of circumstances, general relativity would predict the existence of singularities, places where the curvature of space-time would become infinite. Mm. And people are worried about that. And I think that the correct attitude to take toward it is that probably means general relativity is wrong in those circumstances. And that's okay. That's actually not as terrible as it sounds because general relativity is incompatible with quantum mechanics, which is another important part of physics. So we will someday need a better theory that includes general relativity, but is compatible with quantum mechanics. And maybe in that theory, the singularities will go away.
Sean Carroll, professor of natural philosophy at Johns Hopkins University, author of The Biggest Ideas in the Universe, Space, Time, and Motion, and your opportunity to join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234, where Jeff and Superior are standing by. Jeff, what are your big ideas?
Is it possible there's no such thing as a straight line? Because if everything's vibration, you'd have to stop time. And even then, you can't imagine a straight line because it's moving.
No, Jeff, I think, Sean, you get into this a little bit in your book, if not a lot.
You know, it always depends on what you mean by a straight line. And I hate it that it's true that so many of my answers are going to begin with, it depends on what you mean. But look, if you think about the surface of a sphere, if that's where we lived, as little two-dimensional beings on the surface of the sphere, in some sense, there are no straight lines, right? There are just circles that go around the sphere. But in another sense, you can do what we do in the real world to make a straight line, which is just keep walking in the same direction. There's even a technical term for that in relativity called the geodesic. The shortest distance between two points might not be straight, but it still exists, and you can still walk on it.
What about the idea that everything is vibration in this universe, so you can't have a zero point in time because everything is moving?
You know, it depends, once again, on what level of description you want to go down to. You know, at the fundamental level, we don't even know if space and time exists. So it is absolutely possible that the idea of a straight line just doesn't apply at the level of quantum mechanics and gravity playing together. But that's a regime in which we know so little that I'm not going to make any grandiose claims about it.
Sean, one of the things you do in your book that helps me wrap my head around our physical universe and the things we understand it does and the things we still question about why it does what it does are using thought experiments. And one of my favorite thought experiments from your book is the spherical cow philosophy. As you point out, it doesn't work in dairy farming, but it can be very helpful in physics.
It's an old joke that physicists like to tell only amongst themselves because no one else thinks it's funny. But the dairy farmer wants to improve dairy production, milk production, and they go to the local university and drop by the physics department, which is already a mistake. I don't know what they were thinking, but they say, how do I improve my milk production? And the physicist comes back and says, okay, first, I've solved your problem. Assume a spherical cow. And the idea is that physicists really think like this. They oversimplify the world. They say, like, well, these objects would fall at the same speed if you neglect air resistance and friction and things like that. But the miracle is, in physics, it works. In dairy farming, maybe it wouldn't. Maybe the fact that cows are not spherical is important. And in flying an airplane, the fact that there's air resistance is kind of important. But physics makes enormous progress by simplifying things and boiling them down to their essences and then adding in the complications later. So that's an important methodological insight into why physics is so successful.
And another example you give in your book, and we don't have to go too far into it, but it's just a ball on a hill as a thought experiment and how that directly applies to particle and quantum physics. And it gives you this idea that, you know, once you begin the process of trying to understand our world and what we don't understand about our world is that these ideas are graspable. They are understandable. We can comprehend this, can't we?
I hope so. I mean, that's certainly, I did write a book and I'm hoping everyone in the world buys it. So I do hope so. The idea that I had was that when we teach physics students, we imagine that they're going to be in university for at least 4 years. If they're going to be professors, they'll be in graduate school for another 5, 6 years, et cetera. So we have their attention for literally years of physics courses, and we can go slowly, build everything up, teach them to solve equations, et cetera. And I think that too often, when we try to talk to the rest of the world, we say, you know, oh, well, you're not a professional physics student, so I just can't tell you all the good stuff. But we can, and I sort of want to sneak some of the good stuff in there, not just in poetic metaphorical language, but in the precise way the physicists would talk about it. And it helps you draw connections between things in the universe that you never thought of drawing before.
1-800-642-1234 to join us while we still have some time left. Bruce in Cumberland, you're on the air with Sean Carroll.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. One of the things I found most profound about physics was motion in two directions. And the previous caller had mentioned that everything's vibration. And that didn't really play into my equation when I'm thinking about when I throw a ball, it takes this particular arc until it hits the ground. But it doesn't really travel in an arc because the world is spinning. We're rotating around the sun. Our solar system's moving. Our galaxy's swirling. It's moving within its galaxy cluster. And so it really doesn't take that straight arc. It kind of does some really wild stuff when you boil down what it really is doing.
That sounds like the theory of relativity from Bruce, Sean.
You know, it is wild stuff. I'm going to have to agree with the caller here. There are no perfectly straight trajectories in nature because everything exerts an influence on everything else. And that makes things complicated. And it goes exactly back to the spherical cow question, yeah. Because if you insisted on explaining and talking about the universe exactly and without any approximation, it would be hopeless. There's just too many things going on and everything is affecting everything else. But we can make very pronounced progress by simplifying, by making the universe a little bit simpler than it really is, by ignoring the fact that everything is acting on everything else and just looking at a couple of important things one at a time. So thank goodness for that feature that nature lets us do that and make some progress in thinking about it.
Why is this important, Sean? Not just to physicists, but to people who are walking out there in our physical world. Why do you think physics is still important for people to learn?
Well, I think it's up to them. I'm not forcing anyone to learn physics if they're not interested.
Okay.
But I think that most people are deep down. They want to know what happened at the Big Bang. They want to know what a black hole is. They want to know why it takes energy to drive a car. They want to know why you can mix things but not unmix them. If you just let them, give them permission to ask these questions and learn about what we have learned about them, what we have discovered, and also what we don't yet know, I think it helps dissolve some of that anxiety that they built up by struggling to get a B+ on their physics exam.
Sean Carroll, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon with some of the biggest ideas in the universe.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Professor of Natural Philosophy at Johns Hopkins University, joining us to talk about his book of the same name, The Biggest Ideas in the Universe. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Rick Essenberg from the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty explains their lawsuit to block the president's student debt relief, and a constitutional scholar will be along to explain the ramifications of that case. Join us for that, and as well, tomorrow is also Food Friday with a special. We recreate some of your favorite restaurant dishes tomorrow with copycat recipes courtesy of Taste of Home magazine's James Shend and his readers. If you have some restaurant secrets of your own, we will certainly hope you'll share tomorrow on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, pay transparency laws have been cropping up across the country, including one signed into law last week in California. We'll talk about how they work and what they mean for people looking for a job and some of their possible unintended consequences. First, elections for school boards, town boards, county boards, and city councils are all nonpartisan in Wisconsin, but partisan politics can creep into these important local government offices behind the scenes. In recent elections, state Democratic and Republican Party leaders have contributed to the campaigns of candidates running for nonpartisan seats in local governments. It raises concerns about how political parties and partisan issues might be trickling down to governing bodies aren't supposed to be influenced by the left or the right. So what do you think? 1-800-642-1234. What have you seen in your community's local government? Are you seeing the influences of political parties? Do you think it's important to keep local government nonpartisan? Or do you want to see blatantly Democratic or Republican influences in your school, town, or county boards? You can tell me, 1-800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Our guest is Rich Gruber, former president of the Janesville City Council, retired healthcare executive who's co-founded the community advocacy group Common Sense Rock County. His group started the Rock County Civics Academy to educate the public on how local government works and what candidates need to know to run for these nonpartisan positions. Rich, welcome to Central Time.
Lauren, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And so how big of a concern, from your perspective right now, is there about partisanship creeping into Wisconsin's nonpartisan elections?
There has been a trend that we've observed for perhaps the last 5 or 6, maybe 7 years, 8 years, of more and more activity by organized political parties trying to find a way to, frankly, use local government elected positions as a farm club, as it were, for candidates in the future that would run for state legislature or federal office. We've seen an increase in the amount of dollars that are being directly contributed by organized political parties to local candidates. And frankly, along with those increased dollars going to those candidates directly, we've seen the availability of a lot of political campaign workers who have decided that we'll be out in force to support this candidate, or that block of candidates that want to run for office. And for the first time in the history of the city of Janesville, for example, we had a candidate who spent well over $10,000 to run for a nonpartisan, non-compensated local government office. And frankly, all that does is drive up the cost of John or Joan Q. Citizen who have an interest in running for the right reasons. So we've seen a lot, and that, frankly, is one of the reasons why we formed the organization we have.
Yeah, why are these offices nonpartisan? What would happen if we made our school boards, our town and county boards, Republican or Democrat or another party?
You know, you almost have to go back in history to the advent of local governments. I go back historically to the New England town hall concept of government. And that's when everybody in a particular jurisdiction, the town at that time, would get together annually. They'd have a meeting and they'd transact the town's business. That tradition is one that was nonpartisan. It was inclusive of all members of the community who were of a certain age, and they had a direct hand in dealing with the issues of town government. That carried on when Wisconsin was formed as a state back in 1848. The process of writing the Constitution, in fact, included provisions that said it would be nonpartisan offices at the local level. And when you think about it, the purpose of nonpartisan offices, the purpose of local government, frankly, is it's an extension of state government. It's an extension at the local level to provide the services that the state was providing to the population as a whole. And as such, it's supposed to be nonpartisan, non-political in the delivery of services. For example, if you look through the reform movement that's happened across this country, much of the reforms that have brought us nonpartisan local government offices, as well as, for example, the city manager movement, came out as a result of corruption scandal turned many local jurisdictions into a bastion of leadership by one party or the other for purposes of those folks that served in that party. Imagine for a second if you had a doesn't matter which party, a Democrat or a Republican in the assessor's office assessing the value of property for tax purposes. Would one have to argue or be concerned about a partisan position having that responsibility over overseeing the determination of something that should be fair, unbiased, not influenced by political ideology? So that's one of the reasons why our leaders at the time the Constitution was written wrote in a provision that said we are going to be nonpartisan and those offices should be excluded from any potential partisan ideology that could come into the forefront and steer for whatever nefarious purpose the direction of services provided at the local level.
But Rich, I have to ask about this because our partisanship has to some degree become part of our identity. It's not just how we vote. To some degree, people see it as who they are. It's a representation of their own values that then transcends to the ballot box, but it goes beyond that, doesn't it? So,
well,
what do you think?
It does indeed go beyond that. I like to use the basic analogy of what does city government provide? What does county government provide in terms of basic services? As a former elected official, having spent time for years as a member of a city council, our focus was on roads and bridges and fire protection and EMS services, making sure that we had quality infrastructure that when you turned the tap, the water came out. When you flushed the commode, the sewage disappeared. It was treated in a healthful fashion. And frankly, we didn't get into any great debates about the national or international issues of the day. As a practical matter, I've yet to see a single pothole that I was concerned with filling in a budget process that had either a D on it or an R on it. And for that matter, I can honestly say that I rarely have ever ran into a Republican or a Democratic wastewater pipe. instead, my issues had to do with how do we raise the dollars necessary to ensure that the community has the infrastructure they need to live in a healthful standard of that promotes community.
Valid points. And let me reintroduce you quick here. Rich Gruber is our guest, former president of the Janesville City Council, co-founder of the community advocacy group Common Sense Rock County, which started the Rock County Civics Academy. And Rich, you make some valid points here. So, but also have pointed to the fact that some political party machines have gotten involved in these nonpartisan elections in a way that may squeeze others without the machine behind them out. So how can we best keep partisan politics out of our nonpartisan government?
We believe we have to go back to basics. And by that, I suggest that if people have a better understanding of what the role is of city government, what the role is of your school board or your town or your village government, if you have an understanding of what the elected officials who are serving the community actually do, what are their responsibilities? And more importantly, sometimes, what aren't their responsibilities? What are the areas that are left for other units of government? You might have people that decide that it's really of interest for the right reasons for me to run for my school board or for my village board, my town board, my city council, because I've got an interest in the common good of the community where I reside, as opposed to some ideology that I want to espouse and carry forward to deal with the day-to-day things that are so important to the people that live in our communities. So we went back to the basics. We said education is where it has to start. So we launched what we call the Rock County Citizens Academy. The Rock County Citizens Academy is a series of public education seminars that we've been conducting, and we started with basics. We brought in a panel of folks who are experts in their respective fields, and we asked them the question, what are the qualities that make a good community? And they very quickly focused in on the fact that a good community is built on the basis of public services that meet the basic human needs of those folks living in the community. They are the services that ensure that you have quality schools that are adequately funded to ensure that the educational programs available are such that the industry and business that's necessary in the community is finding the workers coming out of those schools that can take up the jobs necessary to keep us vital and alive. To me, the three principal tenets of what holds a community together are great education, excellent health services, and a quality, honest, transparent, inclusive local government to ensure that frankly we have the environment that's conducive to people living collectively and in some harmony. And can thrive and raise their families there.
We're talking with community. We got to take a break here, Rich, but we'll get right back to it because I want to know more about this Rock County Citizen Civics Academy. And for those who may have questions about it and involvement in it, as our guest Rich looks to remove the partisanship from what should be nonpartisan offices and nonpartisan elections. Is this something you've seen in your community? Has it impacted your quality of life? 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation. How did you put your own partisan political beliefs aside to serve your local community? What advice would you give for others running for local government offices? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. The conversation with Rich Gruber continues on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up the conversation with Rich Gruber, former Janesville City Council president, healthcare executive, who started a community advocacy group called Common Sense Rock County. And he's with us to discuss how to keep partisanship from influencing nonpartisan elections in our local governments here in Wisconsin. And we want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, where Jim in Colfax is standing by. Jim, good afternoon. You're on the air with Rich Gruber.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for taking my call. The reason I wanted to call in is that I happen to be an elected supervisor in Dunn County, Wisconsin, and some of the things that your guest is talking about are things that I've experienced while serving on the county board. That most of us that run for the county board and serve in a public capacity do it for civically minded reasons. We want to take care of our local constituents. We want to make sure that roads are plowed, that our sheriff's department is funded, and things like that. This past election, there were a lot of people who seemed to be running and were being supported in very partisan ways. And a lot of it was based on misinformation. I'd be kind of curious as to what your guest has learned about how misinformation has maybe contributed to some of the more partisanship.
Could you give us a brief example, Jim?
Well, for example, there were a lot of things that people were running against that supposedly our county board was doing, either related to COVID policy, related to how we were or weren't spending ARPA funds, and when some of these folks, a few of them got elected to the county board and found out it was nothing like the boogeyman that we had been portrayed as being, that we were just people, you know, really interested in getting stuff done. And very surprisingly, it was how it's how some of the folks that did get elected went, oh, I see these guys just want to kind of work for our neighbors and get some of this stuff done. So maybe there's hope that some of the folks that are being very partisan about this, when they actually get elected, find out, oh, it's not exactly what I thought it might be.
Awesome. Jim, thank you so much. What role is misinformation playing in some of this, as you see it, Rich Gruber, some of this partisanship seeping into our nonpartisan elections?
Let me give you some concrete examples. In our own Rock County Board of Supervisors, they've had legislation introduced by members of the county board that deal with very critical issues from a national and international dialogue perspective, but really have nothing to do with the day-to-day role of Rock County government. Specific examples, the Rock County Board spent a good portion of an evening's meeting debating the merits of declaring racism a public health crisis. They had spent a goodly amount of time entertaining resolutions that, frankly, had the county board taking a stand definitively on cannabis legislation, an assault weapons ban, an entire discussion on women's bodily autonomy. These are all important issues, but as our friend in Dunn County says, that's not the meeting purpose. That's not the business of county government. The business of county government is to make sure that the roads are plowed, the trash is collected. In those areas that have water and sewers, municipal services, that they work and they run properly, that there is a sufficient budget to support local fire departments and emergency medical services, that the sheriff's department is adequately funded to provide law enforcement services. And while all of these other topics, whether it be cannabis or women's bodily autonomy, are important topics, they don't fall within the purview of what the county board can actually do anything about in a meaningful way. And we've seen the same sorts of resolutions come forward at the city government level. And I feel particularly concerned about my friends serving as school board trustees who've had to deal with the merits of vaccination or non-vaccination, masks or no masks, in their local school systems as a result of the pandemic, and been basically having their attention taken away from the real issues, which is quality education and the infrastructure to support quality education in your communities.
Rich, we got a follow-up here, as Martha is calling in from Menominee, also lives in Dunn County. Martha, you're on the air with Rich Gruber from Common Sense Rock County.
You know, it is common sense. It's great. Love this conversation. Just came away from a meeting here on this referendum that is happening in Dunn County. It's on my ballot. And in an effort to save the county, which is just what Rich was just talking about, upwards of $500,000 a year in health insurance, the Dunn County Board now has put on the ballot a national health care insurance referendum. It's gotten the attention of the folks on the East Coast, folks on the West Coast. It's a pretty amazing thing, and I'm really excited about it. And when the board took hearings on this, not one person who testified identified as a Democrat or a Republican. Nobody mentioned party lines. It was just, how can we save everybody, the county and the county employees, and tax, you know, how can we save money?
Martha, thank you. So a national health care referendum ballot measure in Dunn County. But again, Rich, this sounds like something that may not be the purview of the county board.
I think it's important for county boards to focus on the responsibilities that they have. And while I certainly respect the necessity of using local communities as a barometer for national issues, I'm not necessarily certain that spending dollars to put a referendum on the ballot, an advisory referendum to talk about national health insurance, when frankly those decisions are not made by the county government. Those decisions are made at the federal level or at the state level.
Let's see if, Rich, while we got the time, I want to see if we can get one more in here. Mike in Wausau joins us. And Mike, you're on the air with Rich Gruber.
Hi. I was wondering if you might know why, among the various local positions, county clerks and sheriffs are partisan elections, where you'd think that those would be things based on actual knowledge.
Not just sheriffs and county clerks, district attorneys, and even the Register of Deeds offices are partisan. Why is that, Rich?
Well, that again goes back to that tradition of New England-style town government, where we initially elected those individuals in the towns to be the day-to-day representatives. As the reform movements took place across the country, and I'll use the example of the city manager reform movement that really took root here in Wisconsin in the early 1900s, one of the reasons why it was done was to depoliticize the office of the mayor and the alder persons that served in cities. That movement that fell under the auspices of the La Follette Good Government movement created a professional city manager, for example, with the belief that by depoliticizing the executive function within city government, we wouldn't be subjected to the Tammany Hall scandal sorts of things that were happening across the country at the time. New York is one place in particular. So there was a movement to depoliticize those things, and that was one of the results. Slowly over time, you've seen the change in county level offices, so that you're not seeing the level of county board supervisors, for example, in Rock County are not elected on a partisan basis. They're elected on a nonpartisan basis. And over time, I've had the conversation with candidates for sheriff, and they scratch their head and they say, what does me being the sheriff, fulfilling the sheriff's duties and responsibilities, have to do with whether or not I'm a Democrat or a Republican or a Green Party member or a Libertarian Party member? I would rather focus on the issues of what are the needs for law, what are the law enforcement needs in my community, as opposed to have to hold some ideological beliefs in order to qualify under a party system. And frankly, the change was a direct result of conversations such as this that took place over the years, where people said, wait a minute, it doesn't make sense to have a Republican or a Democrat or a Green Party member or a Libertarian Party member.
And Rich, we're going to have to keep having the conversation, but we are out of time for today. And I want to thank you so much for joining us.
I thank you for your time, and hopefully we can continue at another time.
Rich Gruber, co-founder of the community advocacy group Common Sense Rock County, with us today to take a look at partisanship seeping into our nonpartisan elections. Coming up after the news, pay transparency? What do you think about it? We'll ask you and our expert next here on Central Time.